there, Bruce. It's wonderful to have this opportunity to interview you today. I know that all of those people listening to the Hay House World Summit have really been looking forward to this session. So thanks for joining us.
Joan, I am so delighted, especially to be with you, because our histories and our academic paths are almost identical. So it's really fun to talk with a colleague and a dear friend about this exciting information.
Well, it really is, because the face of science is changing so rapidly, and you've been a tremendous spokesperson for that. And what's really excited is it really helps educate us as to what we can do personally, to have the greatest happiness, in your words, to live in heaven on earth, and also to have the best health. So, Bruce, I'm going to start with a really simple kind of question for you. It's not so simple for others, but here we go. What is the fundamental difference between the conventional science that we've all come to learn and the new biology that you emphasize in your books?
Well, it's a profound revolution in understanding. If we go back to the conventional education that most all of us have received, we can go back and surely remember how we were told how genes control our lives. That at the moment of conception, we're given a set of genes from our mother and our father, and from this set of genes, our life is in some way predetermined as a result of the genes that we get. Well, when we understand this, then things like cancer, diabetes, Alzheimer's, et cetera, are looked at as inherited traits. And why that becomes important, if we just take the conventional perception, is that, well, as far as I know, I didn't pick the genes I came with, and I can't change the genes if I don't like the traits that I have. That leaves us in a very unsavory situation in this regard, because we see ourselves as victims of our heredity, that things are running in our family, and the genes control us, and we don't control the genes, and therefore, I am powerless over the unfolding of my life, so that if cancer is in my family, I can expect that I'll likely be a cancer patient in my future. This is the current conventional understanding. The new understanding changes all that, because it really reveals how our beliefs, our perceptions, our emotions, our attitudes, are all factors that actually control our genes. So the belief that control us is founded in the science that people have learned. There was a term called genetic determinism that was used a while ago. Genetic determinism means your fate is determined by your genes. Well, so this is why when we teach in school, the conventional stuff, even elementary students get this understanding about what we call genetic control, which literally means control by genes. And yet there's this exciting new science that's just coming into the public domain. It's called epigenetic control. Now, it almost sounds exactly the same, genetics and epigenetics, but it's a world of revolutionary differences between the two. So it's significant about it is that little tiny prefix, epi, E-P-I, actually means above. So when I say genetic control, literally that means control by genes, but the new science is called epigenetic control, and epi means above. So literally when I say epigenetic control, I am saying control above the genes. Well, all of a sudden it says, wait, the genes are not in control. What is that so-called control above the genes? Now we know that it's how we respond to the environment. And that includes our perceptions, emotions, beliefs, and attitudes. So as we change how we respond to the environment, we change our genetic expression. Well, all of a sudden it says, wait, old story, genes control me. New story, I change or control my genes how by the way I respond to the environment or the world around me. The critical point here is that I'm free to change how I respond to the world. So as I change the way I see the world, I change my genetic expression. And all of a sudden it says, oh my goodness, we're not victims of our genes. We are masters of our genetics. And all of a sudden it says, well, then if we're masters, is disease a necessary consequence of our lives? Or is our, you know, the heredity that we carry of different characteristics and traits through our lineage, do these control my life? And the answer is no. But the of them does.
You know, it's an incredibly empowering understanding, Bruce, because, you know, as you mentioned when we first got on the line, we have an amazing similarity in terms of our training. We both have doctorates in cellular biology. We've both studied cancer cell biology. And I can recall years ago studies of mice who had the gene for breast cancer. And if they were brought up in a normal environment with a normal amount of stress, most of them actually activated that gene and got breast cancer. But if you put those mice in the equivalent of a low-stress spa setting, you could actually come out with mice who didn't get cancer at all. They were free of cancer, even though they had the gene. And that's epigenetics. And that's what we need to be looking at. So I know you've also studied stress extensively, Bruce. What do you think the effect of stress on genes, not only for cancer might be, but for Alzheimer's, for degenerative diseases? And how can we shift the way that we respond to the stressful stimuli of life?
Well, that's a most profound question, Joan, because it really brings to the forefront an understanding that people have missed. So, for example, they say, oh, yes, here's the breast cancer gene, BRCA1 or CA2. And they say, oh, you have this gene. Immediately, the person who hears that about themselves gets into a very stressed situation because they perceive now, oh, my goodness, I'm a carrier of this very negative trait, and I can expect to get that. Well, right alone, just that stress alone is actually pushing you that way. But the point I want to make is this. There is no such thing as a gene that if you have it, you automatically get cancer. Every cancer gene, which people don't emphasize, affects a certain percentage of the population. So let's say I think the BRCA1 is about 60-some percent or 67% of the population that have this gene have the cancer. Well, what people don't really talk about and they completely dismiss is, yeah, but there's 33% of the population that have this gene and they don't have the cancer. Now, we don't talk about that, but that is the community that is most important to understand is how can you have this gene that supposedly causes a cancer and you don't get the cancer? Well, this is where the epigenetics steps in and says the genes don't control you. You're involved with the selection and activation of the genes by the way you carry out your life, what stresses you're under, or what your belief system is. And why that's important is that accounts for the 33%, let's say, of the BRCA1 gene people that don't get the cancer. Is like, well, just having the gene doesn't mean you get the cancer, but lifestyle becomes important. Just stepping back, for example, one of the biggest killers in the United States today is cardiovascular disease. Now, here's an important fact. While most patients get treated with all kinds of drugs and different kinds of regimen, the bottom fundamental truth that scientists have uncovered and state, but people sort of ignore, is that 90% or more of cardiovascular disease totally has to do with lifestyle. So, well, a lot of people say, oh, yeah, there's, you know, cardiac problems run in my family. My father had a heart attack. My grandfather had a heart attack. I'm expecting a heart attack. And because we say, oh, the genes are doing that. It turns out it isn't the genes. It's the way we're living. And this applies to cancer as well. And that's why there's this always a percentage of people that carry a gene but never express the cancer and the issue. So what's different between them? And it turns out the way they're living, how much stress they're under. So your question about stress becomes very critical because now even the American Cancer Society has found that lifestyle is responsible for 70% or more of cancer. It's not heredity. And it's very interesting that people, this is a finding that if people get this, it's like, okay, this is very important. It goes like this. Scientists were studying the fate of children adopted into families where there was a lineage of cancer running through the family. And they looked at the fate of these adopted children, and guess what they found out? That the children would get the same family cancer as natural siblings. But the problem is they come from totally different genetics. And so when you step back from that, you say, well, how did the adopted child get the cancer? Well, A, it wasn't from the genes. The other thing that was left was lifestyle and how to respond to life, how they were programmed during their development to respond to life. A negative way of responding to life actually precipitates a disease. So it's interesting because science has always talked about the concept of the placebo effect, which is what? I have an and Joan, you're the doctor. You give me this medication and you say, Bruce, this is it. This is the newest and greatest medication for your disease. I take this medication. I get better. And then find out it was just a sugar pill. So let's get to the bottom line. What healed the patient? In that case, the answer was the belief in the drug. So,
well, that's right. And what harms the patient, Bruce, of course, the nocebo effect is just the opposite of that. When you're told... And when you're told something like you have a gene that can predispose to a certain illness, you begin to expect that, and in fact, you carried it out. So it cuts both ways, positive and negative. And I think your work is so very important because when we hear something like that, you have a gene, whether we're told by a doctor or these days people are doing a lot of genetic testing. I worry about people looking at the results of genetic testing when somebody who's not aware of the power of their belief, when somebody's not aware to present it to them in a good way and to tell them, you're not victims of this. You know, you have some free will when it comes to whether or not a gene expresses. And this is a brave new world in terms of the power of our belief and what we know about our genes.
That you know, what you brought up is so fundamentally the most important point, and that is this. Most people, of course, are familiar with the concept of placebo effect. Fewer are familiar with the concept of nocebo effect. What it really says is this. As much as positive thinking can promote a healing through the placebo effect, negative thinking is equally powerful in influencing health, but in the opposite direction. So a negative thought can actually create an illness or can actually cause you to die. And so it's a power of thought, positive or negative, equally powerful, opposite directions. And this is the failure when the medical establishment, for example, doesn't understand that, look, how powerful is this nocebo effect or placebo effect? Why is that important? Because, as you said, I get a diagnosis and immediately the belief that was generated in that diagnosis becomes part of my thought process. And then the next level through epigenetics is to convert my thought into a physiological reality. And this is a scary part because a diagnosis is almost like forecasting a future, not based on your genes, but based on what the diagnosis is represented as you will have this and this will happen to you. As the patient hears this, that translates into chemistry from the brain. Thoughts are translated into chemistry. The chemistry from those thoughts is the kind of chemistry, negative chemistry, that will shape the biology to complement the thought. And that's where we must wake up to the reality that our positive and negative thoughts are profoundly affecting our genetics.
Profoundly. And this is so interesting from the point of view of biology. How is it that a thought can give rise to an emotion? It releases different neurotransmitters, and those in turn release different neurohormones. And this all translates into changing the tissue culture medium. In other words, all the fluids that bathe your cells. How many cells do we have? We have a huge number of cells in our body, Bruce. What, like 50 trillion or something?
Well, it's a number that, look, I don't think a human can even count to a trillion in their lifetime if, you know, doing one, two, three,
yes.
Four, five.
Well,
numbers are way big.
The numbers are way big, and every second, every thought is releasing different neurohormones that go out into the fluid that bathes your cells, bind to the cell membrane, and then you get a signal that goes to the nucleus of the cell, and you can actually change the way that the DNA makes proteins. So there you've got your epigenetics. And how many? We have a lot of thoughts every day. How many thoughts do we think every day?
I don't know. You know, those numbers, they vary quite a lot, but it's thousands and thousands of thoughts. And each one, as you said, a thought is translated by the nervous system into a chemical response. A very simple thing is, and then we'll talk about it, I'm sure, is, for example, if you open up your eyes and you see someone you love in front of you, the sense of love and the feeling of love that you manifest in your head turns into chemistry that comes through your body. And most people are very aware of that. When they're so in love and they feel so in love, they're so healthy. And the simple reason is this: a thought of love is translated by the brain into the release of some really wonderful hormones related, like oxytocin to binding, or dopamine to pleasure, growth hormone, which causes the cells to become healthy. So when you open up your eyes, you feel this surge of chemistry in your body. So when you see someone you love, you feel someone you love. But when you feel it, what does it mean? It means that the chemistry from the brain is now percolating through the body. And the chemistry, as you said, affects the genetic readout. So the chemistry of love resulting from the brain action, if I add the chemistry that is released from the brain when you're in love to a tissue culture dish with cells in it, the cells grow luxuriantly. They're just healthy as can be, as one would expect when you're in love. You can feel that going through your body. In contrast, the same person opens up their eyes and sees something that scares them. Well, they're not going to release love chemistry. They start to release stress hormones and what are called inflammatory cytokines. These are chemicals that, when added to a tissue culture dish, get the cells prepared for protection, which is to wall the cells off from a threat. So basically, you open up your eyes, you see someone you love, the chemistry is causing this great growth and happiness and sensation through your body. And yet the same person opens up their eyes, sees something that scares them. The stress hormones are released in the body and completely change the physiology. We get butterflies in the stomach. We get anxious. We get nervous. And in that process, while feeling those things, what you're really feeling is a chemical reaction of what was released by the brain. And this is altering our genetic activity. And this is why a fundamental fact that stress is the greatest cause of illness on this planet. Stress is a cause of cancer as well. As I said, look, you can have a cancer gene, and if you're not under stress, as you know, that wonderful experiment you talked about with the mice, when they weren't under stress, even if they had the cancer gene, they didn't get the cancer. But if you have that so-called gene and you're under stress, then all of a sudden you start to elicit this nocebo negative experience, which could then manifest as that cancer. So all of a sudden it says, oh my goodness, it's the way I'm looking at the world.
Well, you know, really what you're telling us is that when we learn to see the world differently, we can live a much healthier life. And yet I know that you talk a lot about very little, really, of our perceptions and the way that we create meaning out of events happens in our unconscious mind. A lot of this stuff is old tapes. It's been programmed in before we were 5 years old. So we see, you know, we have, let's say, for example, you're walking down the corridor at work, you see your boss, and your boss doesn't say hello to you. Maybe right away your mind says, oh, I wonder if the boss doesn't like me anymore. And then you go to, what happens if I get fired from my job? The job market isn't so good. And right away you're making all kinds of stress hormones because you had some programming very early in your life that you take things personally, rather than just having a thought that somebody else would, like, wow, the boss is preoccupied this morning, or I wonder if he's okay. And Once these things are installed, these buttons are installed in your unconscious, how do you, number one, recognize, oh, that's a button that's installed. It's not reality. It's just a button that's installed. And then how do you change that conditioning? That's what I think we all really want to do, is approach life from, you know, a more positive, more realistic, curious, mindful viewpoint that cuts through the stress. So what's been your experience with that? How do we do that?
Well, the first thing that you really brought up, and we have to recognize, is this, is that the mind is the thought processes, the action of the brain. So like you look at a radio and I say, well, there's a radio, but the show that comes out that plays through the speaker is the processing of the radio. So let's look at the mind as the show coming from the brain, which is the physical radio. And now we have to recognize this, is that the mind is the show. And then we, as you brought up, and this is the critical part, and this is, if we come to the whole crux of the problem, it comes right to this point right here. It goes like this. There are two minds that that are operating and interdependent, very important word, meaning this. They're not the same. They're two different entities. They're connected, but they're not the same. And so let's make the differentiation between the two. The conscious mind, which is the latest edition of the human brain, which is just behind your forehead, a piece of brain called the prefrontal cortex is what evolved and gave us consciousness. Consciousness is the seat of our personal identity. Our foundation of our spirit, let's say, is connected through our conscious mind. So you and I, Joan, and everyone out there has their own individual conscious mind, which is connected to their personal identity. And here's a very important fact about it, because this is going to play big. The conscious mind, which is you, contains your wishes and desires. The conscious mind is creative. And so basically I say, Joan, tell me what you really want from your life. The creative answer that you give me, a creative answer, by definition, is coming from the conscious mind. So you and the programming of the conscious mind represents your wishes and desires and what you want from life. It also has your positive thinking, which by definition is creative thinking. And I say, well, okay, this is the conscious mind. I say, what's the subconscious mind? I say, well, the subconscious mind is more like an old-fashioned tape recorder. You record a program, and then you push the button, and the program plays itself back. It's a habit mind. So when you learn how to do something, the subconscious mind, once it learns how to do it, you don't have to relearn it. You don't have to go back through all the steps. You can just push the button and it will do it automatically. It's a very wonderful and important mind to have. Unfortunately, it gets a bad rap because people think, oh, the subconscious is the font of evil and darkness. And it's like, no. It's a record playback device, and it facilitates our lives because it says once you learn something, you don't have to relearn it. So, I mean, you know, we learned how to walk when we were infants, and once we learned how to walk, you don't have to do this every day, or otherwise we'd never get anywhere because we'd be just spending all of it. So the subconscious mind has programs in it, and the conscious mind is creative, and they're separate minds from each other, because here's how it works. The conscious mind can control your biology with your thoughts and your wishes and desires. But here's the flaw in the system, and that it's not a flaw. It's actually an important aspect. The conscious mind is not time bound. What that means, Joan, is I say, hey, Joan, what are you doing next week? And if you think about it, your mind will then move from the present moment and will start to focus on next week. And I say, well, wait, what did you do last week? And your mind will then go backwards in the files and try to see what you did last week. Or I say, hey, Joan, in your head, I want you to solve the square root of 3. And what that means is, oh, well, then your thoughts go up into your head as you're solving in your little mathematical playroom up there an answer. The point about this, if your conscious mind is not direct attention to the current moment, it's thinking into the future, thinking the past, or just thinking, then by definition, and here's the problem, by definition, if the conscious mind is busy, we default into the programs that were formerly created in the subconscious database. So it says, when your mind's not paying attention, you will automatically run from the programs that are downloaded into that habit mind, the subconscious mind. And as you mentioned earlier, the subconscious mind is filled with programs, but here's the catch, and here comes the catch, is this, that the fundamental programs in the subconscious mind are not programs of our wishes and desires. They're programs that we downloaded by observing other people during the first 6 to 7 years of our lives. This is a period where our brain is functioning at a lower EEG, electrical activity, in a range called theta, which is also hypnosis. So a child up till about 7, its brain is predominantly operating at a low theta frequency hypnosis, meaning a child is recording everything it sees. And nature designed it this way, very importantly, because of this. Think about it. A child, if you could be conscious, have your conscious mind working at the moment you're born, you're just coming out of the birth canal, and your head comes through, and then we say, hello, welcome, tell us something. And that child will look, go, tell you something. I don't know anything. I just got here. And so it wouldn't be able to use its consciousness because there's no information. So nature creates a situation that says first 6 or 7 years, you're in download. You observe your mother, you observe your father, you observe your siblings, your community, your culture. You record unconsciously. It's not that your conscious mind is even involved. It's just a recording. You record how your mother behaves to this stimuli, how she communicates to kids is different than how your mother talks to other adults, or how your father talks to a policeman is not the same the way that your father talks to his friends. The point about this is, as an infant, we record all these behaviors. So now here's the fundamental issue. The behaviors and how to respond to life that are programmed in the subconscious are primarily recordings from other people. They're not your behaviors, your wishes, your desires, or how you even would do anything. They're other people. Okay, so now we set it up. Two minds, conscious mind, creative, you, wishes, desires, subconscious mind, recorded programs, default mode, and the basic programs are not even yours. Now, here's what science has found out, that on an average day, we are only operating from the conscious mind about 5% at the most. And why is it such a small percentage? And the answer is this, because the conscious mind, not being time bound, is always thinking. It's thinking, as I said, past, future, just, you know, planning what the chores are, whatever you're doing. When the conscious mind, by definition, is thinking, our behavior shifts to the default, the subconscious program. Yeah, but here's the problem. When you're not paying attention, the programs that you're primarily playing are actually tapes of other people's programs, how they respond to life. And when we go back over our childhood, psychologists will tell you during that developmental period, most of that programming is negative and disempowering and self-sabotaging. And so, bottom line conclusion, about 5% of the day, we're moving in the direction of our wishes, desires, and our positive thinking. And 95% of the day, we're operating from pre-programmed database acquired from other people. It's coming from the subconscious. It's a habit. We're just playing these out of habit. And so all of a sudden you realize, well, wait, 95% of the day, I'm playing programs that may not in any way support I want, where I want to go, my beliefs about myself or my life. I am playing other people's perceptions about how they respond to life. It's also, here's the kicker, Joan, this is the kicker. During that first 6 years, a child has to identify who are they in the world that they live in. How does a child know who they are in relationship to the community? And the answer is the exact same way they download other programs. They download what people say about them. And this is where this is a monkey wrench in the system, especially when you realize that parents not knowing that a child is in this record period and thinking that the child is in a conscious period, which is a higher vibration, which becomes more activated after 7. A parent is frequently like a coach of a team. A player is not doing well. So what does the coach do? He gets on him and says, come on, you can do better. Work harder. Try harder. You know, you're not good enough and all this. Doing that in an effort, you know, with the thought process that if I hear that, I will make a better effort to become better than I am. And so parents give this kind of, you know, coaching, like, you know, you're not good enough or you're not lovable and all that, with an effort to try to get the child to improve without realizing if the child is 7 years old or under, it's not conscious and able to take that information and put it into context. If the child is 7 years or under, they just record exactly what the parents say. Now you're 50 years old and you're not paying attention. And guess what? You're on automatic. Well, when you're on automatic, what are you going to play? The beliefs you were downloaded with. Not good enough, not deserving, not lovable. And then people say, yeah, but I would see that if I was, you know, destroying myself with these behaviors. And I go, ah, that's the monkey wrench in the whole thing. And it simply says this: you don't generally see your own subconscious behavior for a very simple reason. The reason why you are playing it in the first place is because your conscious mind is busy. And if your conscious mind is busy, then by definition, it doesn't see the subconscious programs as they're unfolding. So in my lectures, I give the audience, I say, look, I know that sometime in your life, you were very close to a friend. You knew your friend's behavior very, very well. And you happen to know your friend's parent. And at some point, you recognize that your friend shares some of the same behavior as their parents. So you do something like, you know, casual volunteer, like, hey, you know, just like your dad. And then you back away from Bill. Because Bill's the first guy to go ballistic and say, how can you compare me to my dad? And a lot of people laugh because they're so familiar with it. And I go, but that is a profound story for this reason. Everybody else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. The only one who doesn't see it is Bill. And then a more profound point is we are all Bill. Every one of us do this and don't see it. And then we wonder why isn't our life working out? And then you have to realize, well, 95% of the time, you're playing programs that in no way match your wishes and desires. And all of a sudden, and you don't see it. So we invisibly are being sabotaged by subconscious programs. That's a long answer.
Well, but it's very important. That was an extremely useful description of the conscious mind and how when it's thinking, you don't even know that you're running in a programmed mode. You know, I think about the wisdom traditions, the spiritual traditions that talk about becoming conscious and waking up to reality. And I think there are a lot of levels of reality, but clearly one level is the immediate reality that we don't necessarily respond to what's happening. Instead, we react to what we think is happening. And so to wake up like that, to realize, hey, only 5% of me is conscious. How can I bring more of that 95% into, you know, the prefrontal cortex, the conscious mind, the some people have been calling that the wise self or the best self, where then I have more choice. I have more willpower. I have more goal orientation. I have more decision-making possibility, more creativity. And so what would you say? I'm going to bring this to a personal level. I know you, Bruce, well. And what I know about you is you're one of the most delightful, totally most happiest, most loving people I know. The quality of your relationship with your wife is completely delightful. And I know that for you, just like for all of us, this has been a process of awakening and getting beyond your conditioning. What has been most helpful to you in your process of awakening?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for that. And the reason why you see those traits, I believe, is because you and Gordy are a mirror for all of us that have come through our lives and have made changes. And then you say, well, okay, let's take a step back and say, what controls my life? And I say, 95% of your life is controlled by the programs in your subconscious that you got before the age of seven. In fact, there's even studies that reveal maybe up to 50% of our personality is already developed before we're born in the last trimester of pregnancy. And the significance about that is that what your mother was going through when she was having emotional experiences and releasing chemistry from her brain that was controlling her biology, when you're a fetus, you're in the womb, but guess what? You're nourished by your mother's blood. So not when the blood nourishment is what feeds the cells, but nourishment isn't, as we talked about, the only thing in blood. So are the emotional chemicals and all the regulatory chemicals. And so a fetus is experiencing what a mother is experiencing when she's happy. The fetus experiences a chemistry of happiness. The fetus may not know the reasons why, but physiologically, it feels happy. If the mother is afraid or upset, the same chemistry that she feels in her body is also translated to the fetus. So the fetus is getting a secondary a reflection of life by experiencing mother's experiencing patterns that of her behavior and emotions are learned by the fetus. That's the point patterns, the things that repeat. And so by the time a child's born, it already has a pattern of emotional responses. So we were programmed very early. Then we come back and say, well, wait, our lives are controlled 95% of the time by these subconscious programs. And then I say, but wait, many of these programs occurred, you know, well, they occurred before seven. And they were occurring in utero, and they were occurring in the first hours and days and weeks of your life in the first year and two or three. And then you say, well, wait a minute, I don't even know what those programs are. I wasn't really conscious. So then people say, how would I know what my programs are? Do they support me or they don't support me? And this becomes a very important question, because since your life is controlled by the programs, you would really love to have some insight into what programs did I get, and especially when I wasn't even conscious as an infant, what programs went in. And then here comes the easy part, which is kind of fun, is we go back to the science that says your life is 95% coming from your subconscious programming. So then all of a sudden it's simple. It says, oh, your life is a printout of your subconscious programs, because 95% of it, of your life's being controlled by it. So instead of going back and doing psychology and you know, re-experiencing the traumas of your life, which a lot of people do, it's not necessary to do that to see what's in your subconscious. All you have to do is look at your life and say, look, whatever comes easy, whatever that I like that comes into my life because I have programs that support that being in my life. Then in contrast, anything you work hard on, anything you struggle, anything you have to put an effort into because it doesn't come to you, why are you working so hard? And the answer is because apparently you have programs that do not support any of those things. So then you put a lot of effort into overriding those programs. So basically it says, well, if you want to understand what the programs are, look at your life. The things that work easy because you actually have programs to support that. And anything you have to work hard at totally represents the fact that that's your beliefs that are interfering with it. So basically it says, oh, good. Now I know what things I need to work on because it's the things that I have issues with and trying to make things happen. So now you have to say, well, how are you going to identify these beliefs? Well, one of the wonderful, important parts about the nature of community is if you're really close to somebody, and this is rare when you think about it, when you come up with a negative trait or a character or a behavior, and you have close friends that are really close friends that can talk to you, they can say, you know, oh, wow, that wasn't really what you just did, really wasn't supportive of what you want to do or what you want from your life. Then you can get feedback, because remember, most of the behavior is invisible to us because as we're doing it because our conscious minds are busy. So it's very helpful to have other people around, and especially in a relationship, this is very important. Why? Because once you become aware of these negative aspects of behavior, now you have a place or a starting point of what you actually want to change. So this is very important because, as I said, just trying to review your own behavior as it's coming out is very difficult because we're only paying attention about 5% of the time. And therefore, it says, I have these programs. I got them from my childhood. These programs do not support me. They're the ones that disempower me or sabotage me, and especially beliefs about self. I mean, when you go back, and you could just hear parents talking to kids, it always gets my, it just irritates me because they don't realize when they say these things to a kid under seven, that child's just recording whatever they said. And later, when they push a button, they'll play back exactly what the parent said and create behavior out of what the parent said. So basically, the, you know, especially the kinds of things of being not good enough or not deserving and not loving and not smart enough and all these things, these are the impediments in our lives. When we overcome these and change that programming and replace it with the same programming of your wishes and desires, guess what? Then that's really exciting, because it means even if you're not paying attention, when you resort to the subconscious program, if the subconscious program has all your wishes and desires in it, then even when you're not paying attention, you will still be moving in the direction of what you want in life. So that becomes important. And I think the important part that we make is you can change these beliefs. It's important to change these beliefs. Many cultures that are not so westernized clearly have known this for thousands of years. They have all kinds of special ceremonies for young couples as they get together, ceremonies to change their thinking and process if they want to conceive a child. They have all these belief things, because all these beliefs affect our lives a child that we have from our own germ cells, our egg or our sperm, are controlled by genetics, which in turn are influenced by our perception of the environment. So parents are actually genetic engineers shaping the future. Becomes critical.
I think you made a very good point here, both about parenting and about cultural ways of changing that programming. In so many cultures, there are rites of passage for children. In the Balinese culture, there's an early rite of passage. This is a celebration the first time that you put the child down and their feet hit the ground and they actually walk. And they have a culture of totally cherishing the children. And you can see how that gives rise to happier adulthood for sure. But even in something like a bar mitzvah or a bat mitzvah or a coming of age ceremony for a girl or a boy in other cultures, that recognition, I'm going from one phase of my life to the rest, because it's a ritual, I think it probably affects a different part of the brain. Instead of affecting the thinking brain, it affects kind of the iconic memory, so that we have a kind of full representation somewhere in our nervous system of this wonderful thing that just happened. Or as you said, some kind of rite of passage for a couple who becomes engaged, and maybe more so than a party, although celebration is a good thing. So culturally, it's very important to install good software from the get-go. But also in terms of parenting, I know that you and I are both grandparents, and I know for myself, when I look at the way that my grandchildren are being parented, I think, boy, my kids are much more conscious of what they're installing than I was. They are much better parents. There's much more information about good parenting skills these days. And one of the things you talk about pretty frequently, Bruce, is conscious parenting, the importance of conscious parenting in programming a child's genes, intelligence, and behavior. And so I want to thank you for that, because I think it's influencing many people in a very practical way to notice, how are you talking to your children? You said something earlier that I really want to reinforce for our listeners, and that is, parents are likely to act like coaches, like, hey, you missed the point, you missed the ball, you can do better. And to recognize that what we say to our child goes right in there, and to say it in a very positive way, you know, like, ah, you're getting better at tracking the ball. I see how your concentration is improving, is a much different message than, hey, your mind was wandering. Where the heck were you? So that's something we can all do. But I think perhaps it's just as positive to do that for ourselves in terms of the programming of our own self-talk. So what's your take on the movement of the last 20 years or so when cognitive therapies have really gotten very popular, of becoming more aware of the way that you talk to yourself and actually changing that? Have you got any hints for us? Does that work? Does one method work better than another?
Well, Joan, as you said, there's been so many new modalities affecting belief change that are modern and fast and rapid, and they really take advantage of a piece of knowledge we didn't have earlier. Most people are of the thought that, oh, the conscious mind and the subconscious mind are operating in our heads, and that we are the conscious mind, and when we see we're not doing something right, or we screw up in some way, and or we get aggravated, and we go, or we do something that sabotages ourselves, we get into this phase of like talking to ourselves. And I laugh at this a lot, because it's like, okay, you're talking to yourself like, Bruce, don't do that again. Don't eat that donut now. I don't even listen to that one. That's always a troublesome one. It gets very frustrating. Because you say, okay, I keep trying to correct myself. I tell myself, I talk to myself, and it just doesn't change. And then the humorous part about it is, it's like, no, you, an entity, exists in the conscious mind. That's where you are. That's like you have a desk in there, and you're operating everything from the conscious mind. And I say, okay, now you're talking to the conscious mind. I go, who are you talking to? And the reason why that becomes an interesting question is, there is no entity, so to speak, in the subconscious mind to listen to you. The subconscious mind, as I said, like an old-fashioned tape recorder. You push the record button, it makes a recording, and then when you push play, it plays back exactly the same behavior. It's called a habit. Well, why is that relevant? Just think of the humorous aspect of, you have a tape in a player, and it's playing a program, and you say you don't like the program. So I say, okay, go up there and talk to the tape player for a while. And you go up there, you say, come on, tape player, play something different. Come on, tape player, I don't like this program. I wish you would do this. And then I say, how long will it take for you to keep talking to the tape player before the tape is changed? And the answer is, you could be blue in the face. It won't make any difference, because there's nobody in there to hear you. So it says, oh, then what we have to understand is this: there's got to be a way to push that record button. And this is what these new modalities, some of them called collectively energy psychology, some of them called belief change modalities. I have on my webpage, BruceLipton.com, a list of resources, maybe 20 or 30 of these different new modalities, which allow us to push the button and rewrite programs in minutes. When you know how to push the record button, it's a heck of a lot easier than talking to the tape player and not getting a response. And it becomes very critical, because you can change these behaviors when you understand the nature of a way of putting in a program other than talking to yourself, which is more than just frustrating. It's irritating and actually makes you more depressed when you realize nobody's listening to you trying to correct the tape. And what's most important about it is this, because the new book coming out in May is called The Honeymoon Effect. And what I want people to understand is this. I say, listen, go back to the time in your life you fell head over heels in love with somebody. If you can get that picture in your head, and I say, go back to that point where you just were so in love. And I say, were you healthy? Almost everybody says, yes, it was a time of exuberant health. I was really healthy. I say, did you have energy? And everybody laughs, because they know they probably made love for days without stopping for food or sleep. They had energy all over the place. And I say, was life so beautiful that you couldn't wait for the next day to have more? And almost everybody goes, yes. And I go, well, that was like heaven on earth, wasn't it? And it goes, yeah, that was sort of great. And then I say, this was not a coincidence. This was not an accident. This was a personal manifestation. You created that. And then all of a sudden says, well, wait, I created heaven on earth. And then I say, yeah. And then unfortunately, most people after a period of time, be it 2 days, 3 days, a month, a year, if you're lucky, that honeymoon energy fades and then life sort of steps back in to normalcy or so-called normalcy. But that exquisite joy, excitement, love is sort of tempered by just life again. I say, so let's understand what happened. Because if you understand how you created the honeymoon effect and why you lost it, then you really understand the nature that you can manifest heaven on earth every day of your life because you did it. It didn't happen by accident. I say, well, okay, what was the secret? What allowed the honeymoon experience to come into your life? And science has given us an answer, and it's so exciting. Because remember I said, conventional understanding reveals that we only operate from our conscious mind about 5% of the time. 95% of our lives are just playing programs from the subconscious mind. That means only 5% of you operating from wishes and desires. Well, science has now found a very little interesting fact, and that is this. When you fall in love like we just talked about, interesting time, the conscious mind essentially stays present 90% of the time or more. Rather, than being only 5% of the time operating from wishes and desires, what happens to your life when you're operating 90% or more from your wishes and desires, especially when you're cooperating with another person who is also operating 90% of the time from their wishes and desires? Well, then what did you create? You manifested your wishes and desires. And that was that heaven on earth love that, you know, just made you blossom and life was so great. And it was just simple. Basically, it says every cognitive decision, every decision you make in your life, every movement you make in your life wasn't coming from a stored program learned earlier. It was coming from what you want. What do you want? And so when two people are manifesting a life based on their wishes and desires, it's called the honeymoon. And then you say, well, what happened to that honeymoon? Why doesn't it sustain itself? Ah, now we go back and say, look, up to this, you know, while you're in that honeymoon, you've been operating almost exclusively from the conscious mind with wishes and desires in it. But life starts to get busy. Even if you're in love, life starts to get busy. You still got to pay the rent. You got to fix the car. You have your chores to do. And at some point, the pull of normal life takes your conscious mind off of the moment, as your conscious mind starts thinking about, well, what are you going to do next and how are you going to deal with this and all that? Well, wait a minute. If your conscious mind is not paying attention, then the default is a subconscious program. So here's a little scenario. My partner and I are in a honeymoon, love, love, love every minute. It's so beautiful and great. All of a sudden, I realize, oh my goodness, I got to take care of these issues in my life. My mind is now thinking about these issues. My loving partner comes up to me, asks me a simple loving question. And all of a sudden, I turn around and go, blah, 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 blah. And she looks at me and goes, I love the phrase, who are you? Where did that come from? Where did that behavior come from? Well, this is where the honeymoon starts to fade away for a simple reason is this. Where did that behavior come from, that blah, blah, blah? The answer is this. Well, it didn't come from my conscious mind. It came from my subconscious mind. Where did I get that? Well, that's probably the way my father would have responded to my mother, and I just played the tape. And well, then here's the problem. She says, who are you? And then I realized, then this is where the problem comes from. Well, I just played that with my subconscious mind. Well, why did I play that? Because my conscious mind was busy. And I say, oh. Well, if my conscious mind was busy, did I even see what I just said or did to my partner? And the answer is absolutely not, because my conscious mind wasn't focusing on it. I was just accused of not being me. Like, who are you? And then all of a sudden now I get very defensive and I go, what are you talking about? This is the way I've always been, which actually is true, but not seen. What was happening here? I introduced new behavior. It's actually not new behavior. It was the old stored behavior from my parents, but new to the relationship. I introduced this behavior. Had I done that on our first date, maybe I wouldn't have had a second date with that behavior. But up to now, we've been living on a honeymoon. So I've been living off of my beautiful, wonderful wishes and desires behavior. I just throw a monkey wrench in why I played my father's behavior. Now my partner looks at me and starts to recognize, oh, that's not really great. But we have a great relationship, so I'll compromise and go, oh, okay, I like the way he does that, but I'll accept that because we have this relationship going. But every time a new program, actually an old program from our subconscious, is introduced in the relationship that was not there, and if these behaviors are not very good, which most of them are not, every time a new one is introduced, there's more compromise. There's a point where actually a couple won't even compromise. It's like, that's such negative behavior that this relationship is over. This is the freaky part for people to say, wait, I had heaven on earth. It was so beautiful. Then all of a sudden it went to hell. What happened here? And the answer was this. The invisible subconscious program started going back into the normal 95% operating condition because my conscious mind is too busy. Now our relationship is based on two different minds. When I'm in my conscious mind, the loving relationship is good. And when I'm in my subconscious mind, I sabotage that relationship. And then I go, yeah, and here's the problem. 5% of the time you're operating from the conscious mind, 95% of your life is coming from the subconscious programs. And that's what causes the honeymoon to go away. Now, as we talked about very simply earlier, what if I could change the beliefs in my subconscious mind? What if I took those negative beliefs that I was expressing, stopped, rewrote them, turned them into a positive belief? What would be the significance? I go, well, if I ultimately get my subconscious mind to have the same wishes and desires that my conscious mind has, then I'd be operating 100% of the time from wishes and desires, whether I'm paying attention or not paying attention. Both minds would still be playing that wishes, loving desires stuff. And the honeymoon would go on every day of my life for the rest of my life. So we're in a situation here that says you created heaven on earth when you lost the program. And therefore you want to have heaven on earth. Well, then by definition, you really have to rewrite those programs, because those limiting factors, the relationship.
That it's such a wonderful explanation. I think everybody has wondered, hey, whatever happened to that incredible state of union and state of being in the present when you're in love? And you look around and you actually see things. You see that the world is beautiful. You see the light in your beloved instead of the lampshade. You see all of these beautiful things. And I think what's wonderful in part, Bruce, about your pointing this out to people is it helps us to look for it again. And it helps us to ask that question, not only how can I reprogram my unconscious mind, but how can I bring my prefrontal cortex online so that I can be conscious and operate from wishes and desires more of the time? And making that realization when you see the face of your beloved, just to spend a moment there, to breathe, to be present, to be mindful. When you see anything of beauty that suddenly stimulates you to wake up, to spend a little bit more time there, then I think it's possible, little by little, to actually get that honeymoon effect going more of the time. And the love that we feel is, of course, the love for our beloved. But as you've talked to us about so beautifully, Bruce, the love we also feel is for ourselves, for our own deep worthiness. And of course, then how can we help but love the magnificent mystery of creation that that's given us consciousness in the first place? So I just want to say your work has been incredibly inspirational to me, as it is to so many, actually millions of people worldwide. And I hope our listeners will take the time to read your books, The Biology of Belief, Spontaneous Evolution, which has a lot to do with the shift time we're in now, and the evolution, really, of community and of consciousness on this earth. And then, of course, your newly released book, The Honeymoon Effect, which is just an awesome addition to the literature. So on behalf of Hay House and all of those listeners out there, and from the depths of my heart, Bruce, I want to thank you for who you are and everything that you've done. You are an awesome human being.
Joan, thank you so much. And again, I appreciate you and Gordy so much, because when we see you, we see a mirror of ourselves. And, you know, neither of us grew up this way, and that it was something we did. It's a very positive thing that we can do, that we have power. And this is very important, because in the world that we live in, we have been systematically disempowered. And it's time to recapture that. And in closing, I want to emphasize something you brought up that, to me, again, becomes one of the most important parts of our evolution, and that is your self-love. If you cannot love yourself, by definition, you really can't fall in love with somebody else, because if you can't love yourself, how can they love you? And when we look in an audience, when we have a group together and we do testing, we find over 80% of the people that attend actually do not support the belief I love myself. And all of this actually comes from that very childhood experience of realizing through critical assessments of us provided by parents and teachers that we become critical of ourselves. And in that critical character, we lose love for self. We must turn that around. That is, you cannot find love unless you first can love yourself. And I think that's the most important point to close with, because that's where the start of the adventure should begin.
Oh, I agree with you absolutely 100%, Bruce. And one last comment here, just about the nature of spirituality, which we really haven't gotten to, but long time ago, 1895, the first Parliament of the World's Religions in Chicago, Swami Vivekananda, who was really the first Hindu to speak in the United States, said this. He said, "Your very first spiritual duty is not to hate yourself." And I think one thing we can all do when we notice that we're having a self-hating thought is to just look at that and say, you know, I'm human. We all have these thoughts, but it's absolutely not what's true. And spend a moment contemplating the absolute amazing thing that here you are, that you're part of this life, that you're learning and growing all the time, and that love is not a noun, it's a verb. You can learn to love yourself now. So, Bruce, I just want to say once again, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. You're incredibly learned, and even more important than that, incredibly inspiring, empowering, and loving. Thanks so much. Bye-bye now.
Thanks for joining us for this 2013 Hay House World Summit interview. We hope that you found it inspirational, uplifting, and educational. This is a global event, and we're glad that you could join us as we make the world a little smaller.